Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Getting Hammered. This, a special birthday edition for me, Mary Catherine Hale. It is my birthday. When this is coming out, are you excited, my co-host Vic Mattis?
Mary Catherine, I knew it was your birthday now that you're listening to it, so I'm going to say happy birthday. I would have been caught off guard and have to say happy belated, perhaps, but no.
But now you know.
No, but now I know. This is the benefit of this sort of time travel known as the podcast.
That's the magic of podcasting. So that's why I'm wearing this special outfit, which we can talk about. But before that, there's a lot of news. I just want to lay it out.
The big 3-0.
We got some battleground state polling. We got some J.K. Rowling news and free speech news. You love to hear it from a couple folks, including, surprisingly, Fareed Zakaria. So stay tuned for that. An update out of Israel and, sleep divorce. People will want to hear about this. But before we get to that, how's it going, Vic of the Free Beacon?
Hello, Mary Catherine. Yes, doing just fine. Thanks to listeners who were putting their 2 cents in about my Charleston trip and mentioning I need to go to 82 Queen, where they have an amazing she crab soup. I thought that was a different kind of place. That was a bar. I wasn't sure. I was going to go there anyway.
Just a reason to go back.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is, I forgot to mention, you know, my wife and daughter, they love going out to the different clothing stores. Brandy Melville is a big thing. Everybody's talking about Brandy Melville, right? I made a big purchase there.
Okay.
And I thought to myself, am I going to get something that I'm going to have to lug around? Because it was tempting, you know? I mean, there are places where you could find cigars and other places for, like, local bourbons and things like that. And we go through the market. You know, the market in Charleston is a fantastic. It's been there for, like, more than a century, right? And it goes through several stretches of blocks. And it's got everything. It's got food and spices and clothing and arts and crafts. Well, I made a purchase. That is, like, the only big thing I purchased. 2 things, really. One is Charleston Magazine, which weighs about 5 pounds.
Nice.
And also it costs $5. But I love those. I love those magazines. I love those kind of magazines. I'd love to write for them. The second thing, I got a wallet.
Oh,
in the sort of leather goods area.
Right.
Right. And I wasn't planning on it. Of course, my wallet was, I've had it for, you know, more than a decade, maybe two decades.
Costanza and style.
It was, and then I got this new wallet, and you could tell me if this is Costanza style or not. You can see it's bulging out of my pants. I'm talking about my wallet. Hold on. There it goes.
Oh, wow. It's substantial.
So you heard a thunk. That was the wallet, okay? Mm-hmm. It's not like Bachelor Party, the movie. You should, if you're curious about Tom Hanks, it's a funny movie with Tom Hanks. And just type into YouTube, Bachelor Party Nick scene. Okay, it's my wallet. And I got this, and you know what I suddenly realized? I was looking for a wallet that had, I'm willing to be made fun of for this now, a change purse. And Kate makes fun of me all the time. What man needs a change purse? Well, I love to have one, and I suddenly realized I don't have any more change. There's no change. And I don't think Jennifer, it looks gobsmacked. She has her hand on her forehead, that emoji, if you will. And I don't think I needed that anymore because I rarely pay cash.
Of course.
I love paying cash, and I would drive people nuts in line. Even, you know, only a few years ago at a coffee shop, like, wait, I do have 53 cents. I stopped doing that, I don't know, maybe around the time of the pandemic. And as you could see, though, it's got multiple
layers. We got a flap for your creds.
When you go through Charleston, a lot of these stores, they have signs like no concealed weapons. Uh-huh. And I told my son, I said, this is like a concealed weapon. I have to turn that. I could kill somebody.
You could.
With this wallet.
Could take somebody out.
Okay. So
well,
anyway.
Congratulations. What the heck is your family going to do for Father's Day now? You've taken the one leather good off the table.
It's $27.
That's very nice. I believe
it is leather. It smells like leather.
What
do real men, like, what does your husband carry, if I may ask, if that's not too personal a question?
You know, this is going to reveal my ignorance. I'm trying to think. No, it's very nondescript. It's definitely not as substantial as that one.
Is it a clip? Is it like the Sunny Bunch, money clip?
It's not a clip. It's more substantial than a clip, but it's not a large wallet. And, you know, he doesn't usually need a leather weapon because he has another weapon. But but I don't mean that as a euphemism. I was just like, literally.
Again, these references. What's going on here? It's a Friday show. Okay.
It's my birthday.
It's your birthday. You can say whatever you want.
By the way, did you notice that he got me this gift for my birthday?
That is the gift.
That's my
gift. Now, you really have to go to YouTube to see mm-hmm. this because it, mm-hmm. you're wearing the from the Super Bowl commercial for Dunkin' Donuts.
I have Dunkin's. A full tracksuit, orange and pink, with Dunkin's on the front, Boston on the back. My friends who are from Massachusetts are going to be very jealous.
They're going to be very
jealous
of
this getup.
Is that official Dunkin' Donuts merchandise?
You know, I'm
just, I don't see a TM on there.
I'm not sure about that, okay?
I'm glad you got it before they got sued. That's
Who's
good.
To say?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm wearing it proudly. And he's like, well, it was your favorite Super Bowl commercial, so now you have this insane getup. And he knows I like an insane getup, so here we are.
How does it feel?
It's actually, the fabric is nice.
Oh, okay.
It's very warm. I have a tank top under this.
It's thermal like. Oh, yes.
Of the correct variety that would go with a tracksuit. Uh-huh. But it is nice and warm. So I wouldn't wear another layer that is.
Have you walked about on the street wearing this?
I came in the building in this.
Any compliments?
There are some things, I don't know if it's a talent to just walk around looking like a fool and not worry about it, but that is a thing that I can do.
You own it, and they feel that you own it,
that's
and so that it comes off
that's
very
part of the journey, Vic.
Positively. Mary Catherine, how are you? And
good.
Big plans?
I don't have big plans except with Vic Mattis, who I'm going to like hang out with this weekend, but I don't usually make big plans for my birthday, although someday I should because my 40th birthday was in the darkest days of COVID.
Yeah.
So I didn't get that big milestone. During my 40th birthday, people were still dropping, I believe someone dropped a card in a Tupperware on my porch and said, like, leave it there for a couple of days. Like, that's how weird things were.
Did you have like a cleaning spray that you put over people's, the muffins and cookies?
We weren't doing a ton of that, but I did have a little Zoom happy hour back then. So anyway, I should reclaim my 40th birthday and just do it again. But I did have some birthday pie.
Oh.
Because we were down south, as
That's
I noted,
right,
for
as
Easter.
You mentioned.
And while down there, my mom made me a summer berry pie, which is my favorite pie, actually introduced to me by Lauren McCormick, who's the greatest person to make you a pie.
Yes.
Sorry, Mom, but Lauren McCormick.
No, she really is. My mother-in-law says that about Lauren McCormick. Best pie maker.
Top of the heap, man.
Yeah, so, homemade crust.
So my mom made me that pie, and it was fantastic.
Wow.
And it was at Easter Sunday brunch, but there was leftover.
Oh.
So I got to bring that home with me.
I bet it's even better because it congeals the flavors.
Yes. It comes, and you put it in the Tupperware, it becomes kind of cobblery.
You don't even take it. Just eat it with a spoon out of the Tupperware. How do you like to? Do you eat it plain or a la mode? What do you do? Whipped cream?
This might make some of my Southern listeners mad because I know it's more of a Midwest thing. I like to put cheese on pie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen like an
apple
pie with
like
a
apple
slice
pie
of
cheese,
American
yes.
cheese.
Yes, sweet and savory.
Is that what happens?
I know.
I've seen it. I've never had it.
I'm suddenly feeling more self-conscious about that than I am about this tracksuit.
Yeah,
but
I thought I felt bad about the change purse, but the slice of cheese on, look at Jennifer's face. She's mortified.
It's grated cheese. No, it's so good. It's so good. Okay, so I'm a weirdo.
Is. Okay, I'm picturing like a nice, like a slice
on top. It's so good. I would argue, yes, that the apple is the better pairing because, you know, apple and cheese makes sense, right? In people's brains, but it's still good the other way. Anyway, the point is, I lost my pie. I lost the pie, Vic. When we came home, long story, we have a large family. We were in two cars. So we come back home from Easter. Everyone arrives a little frazzled, trying to get ready for school, get everything back in order, bring everything inside. And because we believe in making our fully functional children do things,
good.
We sent them out to clean the cars and get everything inside. So we make them go out to clean. Now we
good,
do the first
as they should.
We do the first round of bringing things in.
Yes.
So the heavy stuff. But then we make them go out and get all the trash,
and do
a little vacuuming with the hand vac, the whole thing. So they're out there, and the two sisters are going between two cars, cleaning
up.
It's a lot going on. And the next day, I'm looking for my breakfast pie, because I got to have my breakfast pie.
The next day?
Yeah. And I can't find my pie. And I was like, my first reaction, of course, as all wives have, is, Steve, did you throw out my pie?
Oh.
Of course not. Why would he do that?
Unforgivable.
So he did not, but I couldn't locate it. So he said, have the girls check the car again. So I send them outside. And lo and behold, someone in the middle of cleaning the cars, one of my children's, I can't fault her for it because her brain works like mine does, which means sometimes you can lose track of things.
There's a lot going on.
So a door got left open mid cleaning out the car.
Like the door is not unlocked, but actually open.
With my pie container and one other piece of luggage or something next to it. No harm has come to anything.
I'm gonna say it speaks well of your neighborhood.
The car is where it should be. You know, we did a little discipline on this fact so that we remember to do this in the future. By the way, I should do the same discipline so that I don't remember to do things in the future. But that's beside the point. Bring the pie back inside. I determined that the pie container has not been violated in any way. Okay. There's been no critters near this. So I definitely ate the pie that had been out overnight on the driveway.
Okay, here's a couple questions. What was the weather like?
It was cold enough for plausible refrigeration.
Okay, was it raining?
No. I don't think so.
I think you're safe.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're safe. You're
here. I mean,
here.
It tasted fine. Now, when I tell you the next part of the story, you might question this decision because the only problem we found with the car is that apparently seeking warmth, perhaps, on this refrigerated night, a cat had crawled in and peed on one of the mats, which is that's a smell you don't love.
You don't. It's very distinct. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, at least it was just that and nothing else.
Well, and also at least that cat didn't eat the pie. That's the important part.
Cat did not eat the
but
pie.
But another thing, and this goes full circle with the birthday gifts. I gave Steve all-weather mats for that car one Christmas. And as a result, we just took that thing out, hosed it down, wiped it down. Everything's fine. But in the future, we should check all the doors to all the cars.
Yes, it happens. But it's good that everything was fine and intact, and the pie, I assume, was delicious.
The pie was amazing, and I'm so glad. I would have been so sad if I had had to sacrifice my pie.
Yeah, if something happened, if your pie had been violated, right? Okay, that didn't sound good.
No, okay.
Do you have, if you had your druthers, as we say, pie of choice, favorite pies? You can pick more than one.
I think it would be this one. I love the
berry
pie.
Mixed
and
berry.
The reason I love it, and it's maybe not other people's favorite for this reason, it's not as sweet as other pies. I don't love super sweet. It's tangy. And I even cut down the sugar in it when I do it because it's like, it just, I like it to be fruity, tangy, a little sour.
Yes.
I'm good with that. And frankly, it means that there's a lot left over for me because people don't eat as much of it.
It's a win-win. You know,
I'm sabotaging my pie making.
It's like me with my tins of anchovies. Really? Yeah. Nobody wants this?
But second is apple. What about you?
Okay. Jokes aside, I really do love a cherry pie. And I know there's a good song about it.
I don't.
But they're very
un-American
hard
of me.
To make because the season is very short.
Yes.
And if you can get them, you can buy cherries, but the taste is going to be way too tart. And to get them sweet, it's just a very small window. But I really do like that. Boston cream pie.
Oh,
it's
that's
nice,
a good one.
Which is more of a layer thing going on there. And banana cream pie and coconut. Okay. A banana cream pie.
I like coconut.
And pecan. I like nuts.
So you like all the pies?
Did I just list everything? No, no. We're verging onto very dangerous territory. I think you're right. There's not a pie I don't like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Honorable mention.
A kidney pie I've never had.
Okay. Honorable mention for me, shepherd's pie.
Well, that's what I was
going
to say.
I'm going savory.
I had a steak and ale pie in London at a pub called The Feathers, and it was delightful.
Okay, writing that down. Okay. Anyway, we should move on to
let's do it.
News.
Sorry.
It's my birthday. I do what I want. All right. Shall we talk about poll numbers?
Oh, yes.
All right. This is the Wall Street Journal reporting. Donald Trump is leading President Biden in 6 of the 7 most competitive states in the 2024 election, propelled by broad voter dissatisfaction with the national economy and deep doubts about Biden's capabilities and job performance, a new Wall Street Journal poll finds. The poll of the election's main battleground shows Trump holding leads of between 2 and 8 percentage points in 6 states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina. On a test ballot that includes third-party and independent candidates, Trump holds similar leads when voters are asked to choose only between him and Biden. That's interesting news that, like, no matter whether they do it with the third parties or without,
right,
he still comes out on top. The one outlier is Wisconsin, where Biden leads by 3 points on the multiple candidate ballot and where the two candidates are tied in a head-to-head matchup. Man, I gotta tell you, if tied in Wisconsin in a two-candidate matchup is the best you're doing,
yeah,
in the battleground states as a Democrat, it's not great.
No, there was a new poll out that came out today that showed Biden up by like 5 points in Pennsylvania.
Right.
So that sort of might change some of the calculus. Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, I think, are going to be very close. But if he cannot win
This was the Franklin and Marshall College poll.
That's right. That's exactly right. Nevada hasn't gone for a Republican in quite some time, and that is already, it's just understood that's going for Trump right now at this point. Georgia, which of course was a big deal, as we all know, in 2020, that looks like that's going without question to Trump as well. North Carolina, I don't even know why they throw that into the mix of a battleground. I don't think of it as
really
a battleground.
That battle-y
it's
anymore.
Back to, it's. I feel like it's reverting to the norm, right? Yeah. Which is going to be conservative. It'll be a red
state. By the way, I do remember, I rarely get into particularly Facebook fights about politics because all of my friends from my hometown are almost all of them are on the other side from me, okay. And that's fine. But I do remember when Obama won North Carolina, there was a lot of crowing about how this is it. Uh-huh. The state's blue forever. Yeah. You will never turn it. And I just lightly remarked on someone's like, hey, you know, that's not really how politics works. So just, you know, like,
right.
This is a victory.
Right. Right.
And also holding states is very challenging, as we've seen the map change a lot over the last
Absolutely.
Three or four elections.
I have a good friend who was so excited about Beto O'Rourke in Texas. Remember, they're going to turn Wendy Davis is going to turn Texas blue. She's on the cover of the magazines. It's happening, except for it didn't. It hasn't.
It hasn't.
And probably won't. What do you say to the people who are trying to stop a panic from happening on the left? And they say, it's a snapshot, Mary Catherine. It's just, if it were held today, fine. But it's not held today. It'll be held in November. So we got lots of time to go and ignore the polls until election
I mean,
day.
I don't think you should ignore them because I think this actually, in a weird way, it might behoove Democrats to have this snapshot in front of your face because it scares you into action instead of what they did in 2016, which was, I don't think we'll visit some Midwestern states, notably Wisconsin, because we don't believe
Hillary.
This guy can win. So I think that part's helpful, but you shouldn't ignore them. So Wall Street Journal continuing, in every state in the survey, negative views of the president's job performance outweigh positive views by 16 percentage points or more, with the gap topping 20 points in four states. Mm-hmm. By contrast, Trump earns an unfavorable job review for his time in the White House in only a single state, Arizona, where negative marks outweigh positive ones by one percentage point. Now, people have some distance from Trump.
Yes.
I would argue that the fact that he hasn't been on Twitter has probably helped him because people are not exposed to his truth rants in the same way that they were to his Twitter rants. Obviously, negative coverage of him is going to go up. Although, gosh, wow. Can they really outperform what they do on a regular basis? It will go up.
Yeah.
People will get used to thinking again about the bad feelings they have about Trump. So that can change. But this is fundamentally very bad on the most important parts of an election for the incumbent.
It is also amusing to watch how the media seems so confounded by these numbers. I was watching a panel on CNN, and the anchors of the show, you know, were talking about how can this be that people give Biden low marks on the border and Trump high marks? Don't they remember all the horrible things he said about the undocumented persons entering this country and calling them all murderers and animals? And then the anchor actually said, he qualified and said, well, I mean, there's some anecdotal cases where some undocumented have, you know, done some things, but you know, small. It's a small percentage.
I mean, the strategy, whether it's on prices or the economy in general or illegal immigration, telling people that what they're seeing with their eyeballs is not real, I do not think is a good strategy. That being said, in 2022, when there should have been, by all rights, a red wave, according to polling, and according to the things that people were telling pollsters, which is that we agree with the Republican Party on the things we care about most, still, let me use a technical term, the wackadoodleness of the right's fielded candidates in close races ended up meaning that there wasn't this red wave, And the fact that Democrats are very good at getting unexcited voters out to vote.
That's right.
Or harvesting those ballots in all these ways.
Midterm elections and really hammering home the issues of democracy and abortion, which is the two issues that Biden does well on. Everything else basically is Trump.
And by the way, still the numbers aren't crazy good for him on those things, because partly, especially on the democracy question, the right and left see threats to democracy in very different mirrored ways. Mm-hmm. And so obviously he doesn't have a huge advantage that pulls a bunch of independent voters. So the journal notes that the electorate seems highly unsettled. About one quarter of voters are either undecided or back third party and independent candidates such as Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a likely signal that many voters haven't decided on a candidate and could ultimately swing behind the president. Except it's not really like, oh, look at this cornucopia of choices that I love. I don't know which one to land on. It's deciding whether you're going to stay home or vote for someone who's not going to win, a third party, or vote for the two crud candidates you've been given, right? That's what people, the undecideds, that's where they're at.
And this is where the media sort of comes into play, because they certainly have a candidate in this race.
They're not undecided.
They're not undecided. My general takeaway of having watched a number of these segments now on the news, I have the news on every day, is the segments basically consist of Biden is doing bad. Look at these numbers. What does he need to do to win? And then they have the panelists discussing what does he need. It's free advice. It's free advice. That's great.
Let's workshop some ideas for him.
Yeah, it is interesting.
The old guy.
And it's free of charge. The idea of the voter amnesia is interesting because obviously the media feel terribly responsible for putting Trump in the White House in 2016 because of all the free airtime. And so they said, we're never going to make that mistake again. But by making people forget about Trump, then people forget about Trump.
Right.
Right. And so.
I know. It is.
What are they going to do?
This is the strange and somewhat dark magic of Trump is that it seems as if everything benefits him.
Right.
No matter which way you go. I do think, look, these numbers could certainly change. Should he be convicted of something, that one of those trials in New York has been set for mid-April.
Yep. That's
they happening. Will likely get a conviction because let's face it, it's New York. However, I think that one that is blunted by the rally around him phenomenon that we have seen happen several times, I think it's also blunted by the fact that there's so much coverage of his legal troubles. I'm not sure people have distinguished between indictment and convicted.
Right. It's all.
And that it's all just there in one pie and that they're not going to really care one way or the other.
No. And certainly.
Like they assume he's already been convicted.
Right. It's baked into the results.
Yes.
And the other thing is,
Jennifer's making a face at our puns.
Sorry. The other thing is, of course, I don't think he could possibly say anything worse than the things that he has already said. So, everybody from the moment of Access Hollywood, everyone thought this is it. They've got him.
Right.
I thought that.
Yeah.
Or the things he said about, POWs. No. So what more can he say now that's going to be so shockingly horrible? It's taken into account.
No, and again, this is part of the perverse incentives of American politics right now, is that when people were discussing DeSantis or Haley, both of whom I argue would be a clearly stronger candidate for the Republican Party, when you're arguing for introducing someone new, the argument against that, even though I don't love that it's true, part of it's true, which is that oh, but we've dug up all the bad stuff on these guys, and therefore it's baked into the pie. And if we introduce this new blood, people will start digging up stuff on them, and then people will start rethinking their thoughts about it. Right. It's like, oh my God.
I have to tell you, there is a part of me that does want to see what the meltdown will be like if Trump wins. I mean, because I'm really not sure. They're working so hard right now, right, to make sure that does not happen. They had this big event at Radio City Music Hall, right? They raised $25, $26 million, hosted by Stephen Colbert and Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden. I'm surprised they didn't bring out Jimmy Carter. What I mean?
Right.
It was like, this is as good as it gets, and all the celebrities and famous people, we all want it. Who wouldn't want this? What are they going to do? And kind of a concern also, once we get closer to the election, it's coming up now.
Yeah.
How are they going to react? What are they going to do before the election and possibly after? We've seen what the other side has done.
Yeah, exactly.
We know that. Like, okay, fine. But
we're not in a great place, guys.
Not in a great place, but I am concerned about what are they going to do.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, by the way, I should note, because I don't want people to think we're being too one-sided by picking on Biden and his Transgender Visibility Day on Easter.
Oh, right.
I should note that former President Trump was hawking a Bible during Holy Week that he sold for like out of 50 plus bucks or something. And it had all the founding documents in it. Look, that's fine, right? The Bible itself, but he's doing an infomercial during Holy Week, hawking his own personal, but Donald Trump edition of the Bible that's like the only Bible endorsed by Donald Trump.
Okay, two things.
And I'm just supposed to act like that's fine?
Yes. By sheer coincidence, a number of hotels in the area have now missing Bibles. Like, it was in the drawer. Well,
actually, there's
one... the Book of Mormon is still there, but the Gideon's is gone.
So there was one moment in the commercial where he's straight to camera and he says, "Love the Bible, have many in my homes." And I thought, is that just because the Gideons put them there? Or does he actually...
Yeah, by homes, he meant the hotel.
Yeah, like those are his homes. He has many Bibles.
Yeah, I want to know...
Love religion. What, gotta get religion back.
What determines his endorsing one Bible versus a different Bible?
You know, I'm sure he's deep into the Aramaic
James,
translations.
Yeah.
No, I think he's deep into the translations.
Oh, okay.
Greek,
yeah,
Aramaic.
Sure.
I think he makes those distinctions.
Yes, he was just reading Marilyn Robinson's reading Genesis. He goes, okay, now my mind is made up. That's it.
He's doing the Bible in a Year podcast. Oh, now that would be one that people would listen to.
Oh, him talking, yes.
Him doing a Bible reading every day.
It would be up there. Do you remember The Simpsons did this? The episode where Homer thinks he's going to die because he ate the fugu, the poison fish, and he listens to the audio book of Larry King reading the Bible. It's very funny.
Oh, we shouldn't wish it. We shouldn't put that in the universe, Vic.
Okay.
Okay.
You did have you'll love to hear it. Is it for this?
Oh, yes. We can do two quick love to hear it's actually. Back to back. Number one, Fareed Zakaria.
Wow.
On Bill Maher this past week, he's asked about Ronna McDaniel. So let me pass forward. Bill Maher asked him a question, and he hands off to the guest this very large question about how do you deal with representing half the country when part of it is that a lot of them believe that the election was stolen.
Ronna McDaniel. Now, if you don't know who that is, she was the head of the Republican National Committee. Ronna McDaniel, not the clown from McDonald's. That's although she probably wishes she took that job. Because, okay, this saga gets to such a fundamental question. That's why I loved when you wrote about it. I want to bring it up now. Okay, so NBC News hires her because people are always saying to the news organizations, you're liberal, let's hear the other voices, and it's not an invalid thing to say. So they hire this Ronna McDaniel, but she was an election denier when she worked for Trump, has since changed her tune. Okay, this is the problem, is like, how do you represent this large part of the country that does not believe the election was legitimate? How do you say to people, you know, okay, we want to include you, but we can't deny that what you think is stupid because Trump lost. What you think is stupid, but we still want to include you. Guys.
You get to go first. All right. So I think, as you say, you've got to remember about a third of the country still believes that the 2020 election was incorrectly decided. That's about 85 million adult Americans. And to be fair to her, she has now said that she thinks Biden is the legitimate president. So really the question is, how much do you punish her for her past lies? And I think the point here is liberals are meant to believe in free speech. I mean, that is one of the foundational values of liberalism. And if you're going to say you're going to deplatform 85 million Americans, that's a lot of people. They say, no, it's not about that. It's that she lied. Well, you know, Bill Clinton lied under oath. I think last time I checked, he's been on MSNBC. They say, well, she's an election denier. Well, Stacey Abrams was an election denier about her own election, and they've had her on. The larger point is, you know, the book I've written is really about this four centuries of progress and backlash. And what you find is liberals often trigger backlash when they use illiberal means to get to their ends. You know, they're like, we're going to do what it takes. And the truth is, and I mean liberalism in a broad sense, liberal democracy, freedom of speech, constitutional, these are precious inheritances that we have. The way you're going to defend it, the way you're going to move it forward is by not cheating, not cutting corners.
Dead to rights on that last one.
Fareed Zakaria talking about Stacey Abrams?
That's my talking point on
CNN.
That's
insane.
You love to hear it.
And he says a lot of other things that drive everybody crazy, myself included. But at this particular moment,
And he makes the point that you and I often make, which is he says, look, if I believe in liberal democracy, if I believe in freedom of speech, if I believe that you want to use all these tools to help people, right. And he certainly doesn't agree with me on policy. The way you're going to move it forward is by not cheating, not cutting corners,
right.
Not having double standards. And he's calling out that this is a double standard, and he is totally correct. He has them dead to rights on this.
Yeah. I mean, he's making a reference basically to things like lawfare, right, which is what we're talking about. And it's funny, he says 85 million, and it's basically 75 million, I think, who voted for Trump. But it's a large segment of the population, right. To say that, you know, we should just ignore all these people is well.
By the way, one of my favorite things to do when I was on CNN regularly was whenever we talked about the intel community and all those kinds of things, to point out that Brennan and Clapper, whom everyone treated as if they were, you know, just come from Mount Olympus with the truth.
Yeah.
Or was it, or should I say Mount Sinai? That's the more Judeo-Christian version. Nonetheless, come down from the mountaintop with the truth. Mm-hmm. They were treated like they were the only honest mm-hmm. men in Washington. And I'm like, these are intel guys who have lied to Congress. Like, they've admitted it. We know this. Now, they've argued they did it for our own good, or that they were mistaken in pretty obvious things, but lied to Congress.
Yeah.
And they would have them on air like it was, like they'd never reference it. I would reference it. But
you have to try them. What do they say when you reference it?
Oh, there was just like the, sort of blanket
what
annoyance
are you talking
with
about?
Me.
And likewise, on CNN, when it comes to like the Russia collusion hoax, they have Peter Strzok on.
Right.
Andrew McCabe.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Stewards of the public truth.
Yeah.
Vic.
Yeah.
Oh, except that they like both, were they both fired for cause?
Yeah.
For lack of candor, at least McCabe was. So anyway, thank you, Fareed Zakaria. I think you're onto something. And you know who else is onto something?
Yeah.
Charlemagne the God.
That.
Charlemagne the.
Mm-hmm.
Charlemagne is always interesting.
Yes.
Like, I don't agree with him all the time.
No.
But he's got tremendous cultural cachet, which is the nerdiest way of saying that he interviews a bunch of very cool pop culture figures and rappers.
And people are listening.
People like him. And he's from South Carolina. He's a radio professional, has been his whole life. He has interesting political ideas. He does not feel like he's painted into a corner. And Comedy Central wisely has given him more of a platform.
Okay.
And I think he's the guy you put candidates in front of as often as you can, because he asks interesting questions and because he's not really in danger of being canceled. So here he is doing a bit on The Daily Show about DEI, and you love to hear it.
But here's the part where you all stop applauding everything I say. The truth about DEI is that although it's well-intentioned, it's mostly garbage, okay? It's kind of like the Black Little Mermaid. Just because racists hate it doesn't mean it's good. And you know I'm right, because every one of you has sat through one of those diversity training sessions and thought, this is some bullshit. And it's not just you. Over 900 studies have shown that DEI programs don't make the workplace better for minorities. In fact, it can actually make things worse because of the backlash effect. Remember D.A.R.E. from school? Y'all remember D.A.R.E.? Yeah. She said, woo. DEI training is like D.A.R.E. for racism. And you all know how effective that was. I was sitting there going, oh, shit, there's a ton of fun drugs I should try. I didn't even know about Molly. Thanks, Officer John. But the biggest failure of DEI is that the number of Black people in power at big companies is basically the same as it was 5 years ago. In fact, maybe the only thing that DEI has accomplished is giving racist white people cover to be openly racist.
D.A.R.E. You know, just as a quick aside, I was an intern at the Justice Department many moons ago under the original Bill Barr 1.0, and I was writing letters on behalf of POTUS.
Okay.
And I wrote for first George Bush, H.W. Bush, and one of the letters I wrote was to the D.A.R.E. program. So it came to these, it came, Drug Abuse Resistance Education.
Mm-hmm.
And
D.A.R.E. To keep kids off drugs.
And they received it, and it was from the president, but it actually was written by me.
Oh, look at you. Look at
but,
you.
But he's right.
It's not just DEI that's bullshit.
Right. Well played. And it was the same thing with RAD. Remember RAD, Rockers Against Drugs?
Oh, I forgot
you know,
about that,
that
one.
That's what, I forget which a comedian said, it was like Christmas without Christ, you know? I mean, it's like, really? But anyway.
No, he's right. Like your gut feeling about the seminar you're sitting through, conducted often by like someone like Robin DiAngelo, who's just a really rich white lady who's learned to get more rich talking about this, is nonsense. It's mostly garbage. And highlighting all of our divisions maybe doesn't do the best work getting us past racism. But I don't think that's actually the point. Anyway, I appreciate his unconventional take on it.
Does this mean the pendulum...
counterintuitive take on it.
Is the pendulum swinging, beginning to shift back on DEI? Certainly, as a word.
Yeah, I think people are, they're going to just name it something else and keep doing it. But I do think in some of these places where you have public money going to these DEI racket departments, you should be very careful about how many people you employ doing this work, mm-hmm. whether they actually produce anything of value. Taxpayers should, you know, have their money treated carefully in that way. So where you can, cut it. And some people are doing that. So I think we are having a bit of a turn. And then I think in the investment world, like with the
BlackRock,
with the BlackRocks of the world, states wisely, I believe West Virginia was the first one to do it, have divested their large pension funds from BlackRock, saying to BlackRock, hey, if you're not going to make making money the priority, we can't be invested. Particularly West Virginia, they're like, if you're going to make our industries the enemy of your investment fund, we can't be invested. And that has hurt some of these organizations.
And that has also forced BlackRock to back off of DEI and say that that's not really our concern.
Although,
right,
I guess,
now,
what is it called for investing? It's something that's a different
ESG.
Acronym. ESG.
Yes. So there you go. That's right. That's ESG.
ESG.
In any event.
All right. Shall we talk about J.K. Rowling?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It was no April Fool's joke, reports Politico Europe. Harry Potter author turned culture warrior J.K. Rowling kicked off the month with an 11-tweet social media thread in which she argued 10 transgender women were men and dared Scottish police to arrest her. Rowling's intervention came as a controversial new Scottish government law aimed at protecting minority groups from hate crimes took effect, and it landed amid a fierce debate over both the legal status of transgender people in Scotland and over what actually constitutes a hate crime. Already, the law has generated far more international buzz than is normal for legislation passed by a small nation's devolved parliament. U.S. podcaster Joe Rogan and ex-owner Elon Musk are among those to have waded in alongside Rowling. The row, Musk says, is an example of why it's important to preserve freedom of speech. Scottish First Minister says, this bill is about protecting people against a rising tide of hatred we see far too prevalently in our society. Could I love J.K. Rowling more?
We're very fortunate that she is in the financial and cultural position that she is in. She's got a lot of cachet.
Yep.
And other people, I think, you know, they would have been canceled and their lives destroyed so fast for sharing what used to be only a few years ago very common sense opinions that nobody would have even thought to question regarding biology, sex, gender assigned at birth. Even the New York Times is jumping on this now and saying these things are a mistake. It's a slippery slope, I was going to say. It's like the old phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And see, yes, things that are hurtful. We don't want to have
that. Yeah, don't say icky things.
Don't say icky things. And it might be great when they're enforcing it against people who say things against the things that you love.
Right.
People are saying bad things about the police. Oh, you know, you can't do that. Okay, great. And then suddenly it's things that you do love and something, perhaps it's the law itself. Can you criticize the law? So it's a very slippery slope. It's called the Hate Crime and Public Order Act of 2021. And one of the things they talk about is, you know, you could be, convicted of a crime of, quote, stirring up hate.
Yes, which is like real slippery language. Stirring up hatred against groups with protected characteristics. Under the bill, someone behaving toward or communicating material to an individual in a way that could be considered by a reasonable person to be, quote, threatening or abusive, could face a maximum penalty of 7 years in prison. Now, apparently, after she shared this thread, Scottish police announced they would not be investigating the Harry Potter author's remarks as a crime, as some of Rowling's critics have called for. So it's like they also do this fun thing where it's like, oh no, it's not just about speech stuff. No one's threatening your rights, J.K. Rowling.
Right.
Why do you act like any of your rights are being taken away when no one's bothering you? Just live and let live. When in fact, those same people, or at least that same ally group, is like, oh, you should definitely arrest her for her speech.
Yeah. They make the worst authoritarians.
It's really bad.
It's along the same lines of people who decry book banning. And we're going to have, like, you know, libraries that have a special section on books that are banned.
Yeah.
But then they're like, please ban J.K. Rowling's books.
Yes. By the way, I want to say,
words are violence.
Just as a perk of being not a super dedicated culture warrior, I have been able to enjoy J.K. Rowling's books at all stages. Because you'll remember when they first came out that some Christians and right-wing folks, conservatives, argued that they were problematic because of the occult.
I was going to say paganistic or Satanistic.
Yeah, and didn't want kids reading them. And then now it's like we've gone 180 and the left hates it because of her. And I've just been open to it throughout. They're fun books. They're fun.
That is a good call.
Yeah.
That is a good call. And you know, I mean, if you're with J.K. Rowling and with, for example, the Game of Thrones books by George R. R. Martin, they've read all the classics and they're taking from them. So throughout the series of books by both authors and other authors, obviously, you're seeing all these hints of Tolkien, for example, or Greek mythology, for example. And so it's a richer history of that.
Also, I always enjoyed, I didn't read them till much later, but I did enjoy about the Harry Potter books. I was like in just the wrong demographic when they came out. So I just was like a little too old for them when they came out. And I was not an adult Harry Potter reader. I adopted them when my kids were old enough to enjoy them. So then I read them to them. And it's been very fun. And I had a larger point that I've now forgotten. Oh, I did enjoy about this series of books when it came out, even though I wasn't reading them, that a lot of kids were reading these long books for the first time in their lives. Yes. They had picked up a tome, right? And I think that gives you confidence for reading other things in the future. So I thought that was
a really
good byproduct of that. But man, there's a lot of sad lefty millennials now who have lost this cultural touchstone, which may have been the only one they had.
Yeah, that was...
Remember the period of time where everything was compared to Harry Potter because the millennials were taking over Twitter? And everyone was like, "She's read another book. Read one other book.
Yeah. Outside of that.
He's just like Voldemort." you're not supposed to say his name. Sorry.
But that's right. But you wouldn't put it past Scotland or England, for that matter, sadly, to actually enforce some of these speech laws. Remember, I was going to bring up the pro-life activists outside the abortion clinic who were asked on video by police, are you praying in your mind?
Yeah.
Are you, because you can't do that. And they want, it's a thought crime. Are you praying in your mind? There was a guy, this goes back to 2011, and he got arrested for singing the old 70s song, Everyone Was Kung Fu Fighting, because apparently an Asian person complained.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. They have no charges pressed, but that is crazy.
This is the beauty of the First Amendment and the reason that having wide latitude for what people can say in public is good is because the person praying was arrested. The person praying silently.
Yeah,
they're interviewed by police. The other day, there was footage out of the UK of someone with a swastika at a pro-Palestine gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely, that was okay. That was sort of like, oh, stand down. Well, that's because things are selectively punished. And in that particular situation, even if the police believed that this did cross the legal line, perhaps in that crowd, they're not going to enforce that law.
Right.
The quietly praying person, probably no cost to the police person.
It's easy to go after them.
Always going to be the result if you have this on the books. Ugh.
It's political cowardice.
Good for J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to go home and read some more Harry Potter. We're on the second to last book. Yeah. It's been a many years journey.
Deathly Hallows.
Which one are we on? Yeah, we're on the second to last one. So we're on, help me out. Jennifer's younger than I am. Oh, Jennifer hasn't read them.
No, I'm doing this based on the movies. Did they break up Deathly Hallows as a book to part one and part two? Or was it just one big book?
I think it's
Half-Blood Prince.
Half-Blood Prince. The one. Thank you, Vic.
You're welcome.
All right.
So you're saying that after the movies came out, she turned it into a book?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't trigger people. Okay. We have some really tragic news out of Israel, as if the news isn't frequently tragic, but especially this time, where a strike mistakenly hit aid workers in Gaza who were working for
World Central Kitchen.
World Central Kitchen, which is Jose Andres' organization, which is a very good organization that does work all over the U.S. and all over the world, getting food to those who need it. The Israeli Defense Force has said this was a mistake. We thought an armed Hamas person was in one of these vehicles or was one of the, owned one of these vehicles. This, of course, has taken a very ugly turn, not just the tragedy of the deaths, which I believe is how many people? Is it seven people? Seven people. But of course, the chorus comes out to say that this was intentional.
Right.
And that, I don't understand. Look, I understand that people are anti-Semitic. We've seen that clearly.
Yes.
But surely, even the anti-Semites do not believe the Jews are dumb.
Right.
Right? So explain to me how this works to their advantage.
Right. What did they have to gain by doing this intentionally to prevent? We must bomb this car because it was going to get food.
Right.
To Palestinians or whoever, refugees. The initially, it was characterized as being this, you know, awful, indiscriminate act of violence.
Right.
And Jose Andres, understandably, was in a state.
Yes.
And it was like, this indiscriminate violence by Israel has to stop. And then later on, he's like, this act was deliberate. Okay. It was deliberate in the sense that a car was targeted specifically. It wasn't like, this is not the bombing of Dresden or the firebombing of Tokyo, right? They had pinpointed this car or cars mistakenly. They thought, as you would mention, that it was they were hostiles. That was a mistake. It was awful collateral damage. It's a war zone. We tend to forget.
Yeah,
Since like the first Gulf War, these surgical strikes with very minimal non-military casualties, we'd like to think. And so when something like this does happen, you know, it's shocking. It's news. Israel admits to it. They're not trying to cover this up.
Well, and they've started an investigation which will be completed within a week or two. The victims, by the way, were a Palestinian, a Pole, an Australian, a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, and three British security advisors. Yeah, there is a part of this where all the aid workers, many of whom, the ones who aren't Hamas operatives, those that are genuine folks who are on the ground trying to do good things, they're working in a war zone.
Yeah.
Right? That just as the press works in a war zone
it's very dangerous.
Case of Ramadi or something, right? And tragically you lose people in those situations. But I think you're right, we get sort of inured to the idea that that people can have free rein in a war zone and they really can't realistically. It also highlights, of course, like as you said, Israel's addressed this. The world is very angry. Most of the people who are very angry about human rights violations are much more angry about this than they are about we're coming up on the 6-month anniversary of October 7th, which was deliberate, joyful targeting of thousands of civilians.
That's right.
There is a moral difference between waging war that way and waging war in the way the IDF is, which is to defeat this terrorist organization while trying to minimize civilian casualties, which is why it's taken this long.
Yeah, exactly.
If they weren't doing that, they'd be done by now.
When a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket mistakenly hits, you know, the parking lot of Al-Shifa Hospital, they don't exactly admit it and say, sorry, we did this. And it's not like the media really cared.
Well, an Israeli died at the hands of Hezbollah. One of the rockets landed so that it was a fatal strike.
The difference is they kill civilians intentionally.
Yes.
And Hamas does.
Yes.
And that's known as resistance, and it's justified. You know, when it's an accident and you admit to it and you're going to have an investigation, well, then it's, you know, as Biden said, ceasefire immediate.
Well, meanwhile, the military geniuses over at the White House, and by that I mean Karine Jean-Pierre, suggested in the briefing that, you know, there's just got to be another way to win.
Yes. The other way is for Hamas to surrender and return the hostages.
Look, I'm glad that she wants them to win. At least she's saying that, right? But the truth is, if you tell them they can't do anything in Rafah, then you're telling them to lose.
Right. No, so, I mean, the option of leaving Hamas in place, if you just stopped right now and left Hamas there, that for Israel, that is not one of their options.
Yeah. And by the way, there's plenty of political turmoil in Israel itself about the fact that particularly the hostage families, there's sort of a schism between those who believe that remain sort of behind the unified government and those who say this has taken so long and you've abandoned our families to this. So there's real problems that Netanyahu and his allies face on the home front. But the issue isn't whether to fight the war, right? That's not the issue.
Everyone wants the hostages returned.
Yeah, but you're right. We should always state that it could be over right now if they gave the hostages
surrendered. What is the difference between October 6th and 7th when everything was great and the place was not rubble? Yeah. Well, something happened.
Well, you remember, I also do like how the characterization changes, where they say it was an open-air prison, there's nothing there, people. And then as soon as Israel comes in, it's like Gaza City was a paradise.
Right.
Well, it's like, okay, well, which one was it?
Yeah.
Which one was it? All the amenities in a paradise.
Both ways.
Things change conveniently.
They do.
Anyway, Andres, unfortunately, was one of those who said it was deliberate. He was, but yeah. He's, you know, in grief, and as is that entire organization, so I
hope that all of them are
they're in our purse.
Yes, and he's like, he's transcended celebrity chef. Like, you know, I would have been happy just to have my a three-star or four-star restaurant and leave it at that. And he decided, I remember when he just had one little restaurant called Haleo.
I know.
In the 1990s.
Great, great little place.
And yeah, and you know, I mean, you know, hats off to him. He really is a humanitarian. I met him during my food writing days.
Yeah.
Talked about what the neighborhood was like at the time. But it's a lot going on.
By the way, I tweeted this, but, you know, Andres has the excuse of being a chef,
yeah,
right? As opposed to the UN special rapporteur, yeah, on this particular conflict,
mm-hmm,
who is just a total disgrace, this Francesca
woman. Yeah.
And she just tweeted it. It's like, definitely on purpose.
Yeah.
This is a pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They wanted to go after the people giving food.
Yeah. All right. We'll have more on that in the future, or more on Rafa and whatever engagement happens there.
Yeah.
But a lighter note to end. Shall we talk about the sleep divorce trend?
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's lighter. This could end up badly.
Could this
if
be my polarizing? Wife
yes.
Oh,
polarizing.
I see.
If my wife
bad on the this. Home front. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Shall I?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this was in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm just going to read an excerpt.
Okay.
Which I printed in 18 point, because as you can see here, I'm blind as a bat. You laugh. I'm just going to read. So what I'm reading to you now is from the journal. Elizabeth Pearson and her husband Ryan have been married for 16 years, and for half that time, they've slept in separate bedrooms. Quote, "We both travel for work quite a bit, and we noticed that we slept great in hotels," said Elizabeth, 42, author, executive coach. "Where we slept poorly was when we were at home in the bed together. Ryan, 47, is 6'6", snores like a chainsaw, has restless leg syndrome, and on one occasion punched Elizabeth in the face while sleeping. Waking up angry at him every morning was driving a rift in the relationship. The couple now share a 6-bedroom, 4-bath Mediterranean home in Laguna Niguel, California, that they purchased in 2017 for $1.5 million,
mm-hmm,
which is, by the way, the size of a very small home in Arlington now. They completed,
I was surprised by that price tag, too.
Moving out to Laguna Niguel and a time machine. They completed a 500-square-foot renovation earlier this year that cost $95,000, adding a loft and bedroom. Now Ryan sleeps on the first floor. Elizabeth sleeps on the second, each in a bedroom with an ensuite bath. And their marriage is thriving. Many couples are opting for sleep divorce, choosing to use so-called snore rooms or dual primary bedrooms instead of following the typical marital path of sharing a bed. Typical. According to a survey conducted in March by the 2023 by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, 35% of Americans now sleep in separate rooms occasionally or consistently. Millennials are most likely to sleep apart at 43%, according to the survey, compared with just 22% of boomers snoozing separately. Mary Catherine, do you have thoughts?
Interesting. So I think this could be healthy for people. I don't want to influence Kate in any particular way. Now, I don't have this particular problem because we have a large bed and neither Steve nor I is a big snorer.
Good.
Right?
Yes.
So like, I don't want to brag about our superior unobstructed airways, but that is helpful, right?
Yes.
If someone next to me were like, mm-hmm, a big snorer, mm-hmm, yeah, I would consider vacating,
yeah,
to get better sleep. I don't think there's anything totally wrong with that.
I only snore if I have a bit to drink.
Okay.
But other than
so
that.
So rarely.
Yes, rarely. Rarely. Once in a blue moon. Whenever I travel, I'll say to Kate, "How did you sleep?" And she'll say, "I slept great." And I said, "I sleep terrible." So she says,
okay,
sleeping, she says it's like sleeping next to a dog is what she describes it as, me, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
And for me, I'm very needy.
Okay.
I'm very needy.
Yeah,
I'm,
you just need
which is like,
presence.
I know, I'm like, what's it, Mike Yanagita from Fargo. Marge, I'm so lonely. I'm so lonely, Marge, you know? And she's like, you know, we go to Charleston and we got this king size bed.
Yeah.
Too big.
Oh, no, yeah.
Too big.
In a true king.
Yeah.
It's like someone's three rolls away.
Three. That's exactly
three
right.
Three barrel rolls away.
That is exactly right, Mary Catherine. And it's like 3 or 2 in the morning. I'll have to roll over,
yeah,
and then I can find her. And then I'll say, "I found you." You know, that's how lovely it is sleeping next to me. So,
well, anyway. So I thought I had read this before, And yeah. I re-looked it up. There's some evidence, and look, I'm not vetting this very carefully, guys, so just keep that in mind. There's some evidence that women fall back asleep better than men do. Like once
yeah,
they've
okay.
been woken
I
up.
I think that's true.
And as a result, that when men and women sleep together in a bed, that we're just doing us ladies is just sucking the life force out of these men because they can't sleep, but we're fine. Like, oh,
right.
I'm just gonna go back to
sleep. I'm a very light sleeper.
And part of the reason they think that women are better at falling asleep is because they are evolutionarily designed to be able to wake and help a baby and then get sleep again. Now, some of the postpartum moms out there who might be listening will be like, that's nonsense. I don't get good sleep. But I'm just saying that's mm-hmm. one of the things. But I turned it up. The research from the University of Vienna, you'll appreciate that.
Yes, found that my alma mater.
That when men slept with a partner, they performed worse on cognitive tests than when they'd slept without a partner. They also displayed higher stress hormones. Women, on the other hand, did not display such drastic changes in mental ability and stress. They were able to reach deeper sleep when sleeping with a partner. Now, the thing that will go the other way and make the women annoyed, males are generally able to fall asleep more quickly than females, which anyone who's ever had a male partner will know. It's like you look over and it's like 3 seconds later he's asleep, and I'm not even a bad sleeper. I don't have like super high stress, or my brain's not running on overdrive most of the time, and I can fall asleep pretty easily, but man, he's fast.
No, that's true and weird, because sometimes I usually read to fall asleep and it'll take me about a page or two and that's it. I'm ready. I'm conking out. As soon as I fall asleep, I'll immediately start dreaming, and then I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh my gosh, what time is it? Oh, it was like only 15 minutes later. And I'm like, wow, that's weird. And Kate's like, you fell asleep and already had a dream and I'm still awake.
This reminds me that I should end with my silly dream that I told you about earlier.
Oh, yes.
I know telling people your dreams is not like the most exciting thing, but this one was very silly. Which is that I believe Vic might have been there. It was the old Weekly Standard crowd.
Okay.
Vic was there, I think, Sunny Bunch, a couple other people, you know, the editor crew, and we were kidnapped.
Oh, yeah.
Along with none other than Method Man. If you're not familiar with him, look him up, both to listen and to look at him.
He was great in The Wire.
Handsome rapper. Yeah. We were kidnapped, and then we were made to do some sort of like very dangerous deal. But Method Man was the one who went out and did it. But then I later found out information that he had formerly been like a sharpshooter or a SWAT guy or something, or special forces, and that he would be safe. So
Method Man was
everything turned out okay.
It turned out that he's on our side. Got nothing to worry about.
Don't worry about it, guys. I don't know where that one came from.
Thanks to Method Man.
But anyway, I don't object to this. One of the things that was interesting to me is this seems like also a square footage issue.
Yes.
Right? Like,
I was going to say there's a bit of a privilege thing here because it's great to do if you can, if you have the means.
Like,
otherwise,
just,
I'm sleeping on a couch.
Right,
that's
let's
the
just
option,
say
not a room.
Pa and Ma Ingalls weren't sleeping in different rooms, right?
No. Everyone's
wasn't
together.
Happening. But I am led to believe, right? So I've always heard that when you saw the Brady Bunch set up with the two twin beds, that was like a censorship thing. But
then some
of the research suggests that there have been plenty of times throughout history when married couples didn't necessarily sleep in the same bed as a rule.
Right. Okay. So
certainly the queen and the king.
I believe
in the crown.
I believe in Brady. Yes, that's right. They had separate rooms.
Yes, separate whole quarters.
Okay. I believe in Brady Bunch. I think they are in the same bed. Right. But like,
oh, more that maybe.
I love Lucy.
Yeah.
I love Lucy. Separate beds.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say I at this point, I would be happy with separate bathrooms. Right. Which is kind of true. I moved my stuff downstairs. We had at our hotel.
Yeah.
This, you know, two vanities.
Right.
It was really exciting to have two vanities. So I said, great. We finally have our space. I said, this is amazing how in peace, but eventually. Like a curler or one of those hair flatteners is now into my sink area. Yeah. She has another sink. Next year, I find long brown hair. That's not mine.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a picture from my wedding weekend to Steve in which I have side by side on our vanities, woman getting ready for a wedding, man getting ready for a wedding. And it is like insane the difference in product number and tool number. In fact, I'll try to dig that up. Maybe we can put it on the Instagram. Is that all we got?
That is all we got. I do have a call out.
Okay.
To myself.
Okay.
Yes,
well done, you.
So thank you to you and Hugh Hewitt mentioning me on his show, his
great
show.
There you go.
And he was wondering, where did you find me? I've been here all along, but this is the lot. This is oftentimes the lot of the editor.
Yes.
You know, 20 years at the Standard as, you know, working to help other people's quality of copy.
Right, which is why you were kidnapped to do a very dangerous drug deal.
Yes. That's the Method Man. With the Method Man. And the book Vodka came out 10 years ago, if you can believe that. So it's been a while, but thank you for bringing it up and boosting sales.
Of course. And next
and
week,
Hugh.
Next week we are going to work on a tax day cocktail for you guys.
Oh, boy.
Speaking of vodka.
Yeah,
so.
Well deserved. Okay. That wraps up this episode of Getting Hammered. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. You can follow me on Twitter at Victorina Mattis, and happy birthday again.
Thank you. I'm at MK Hammer on Twitter, at MK Hammer Time on Instagram. Follow the show at Getting Hammered Podcast on YouTube or Instagram. Thanks for getting hammered responsibly. This has been a Nebulous Media Podcast.